From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and soundbites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Joseph Backholm.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm. My pleasure to be with you. Today on the program, Kamala Harris has released some details of her economic plan. What are those details and will they help? We'll talk about that today. In addition, a good news story. 11 pastors and two lawyers wrongfully imprisoned in Nicaragua have been released. Why were they imprisoned in the first place for 9 months? We'll give you the details as well as the details of their release later in the program. Also, in tragic news yet again, there was another school shooting yesterday in Georgia. And that came on the heels of the release of the manifesto from the Covenant school shooter in Nashville. Why does this keep happening? Jennifer Bowens has decades of experience dealing with trauma and mental health, and she'll sit down to help us think through all of that later in the program. And before we get to our top story of the day, I want to remind you that the Pray Vote Stand Summit will be held in Washington, D.C. from October 3rd through October 6th. This national gathering of spiritually active, governance-engaged sage cons recognizes that change must flow from spiritual renewal. Now, registration for this exciting event is now open. I ask that you join us as we pray for our nation, engage in government and culture, and stand for biblical truth. Visit prayvotestand.org for details and to register. And now to our top story of the day. During his first press conference since the recent murder of six hostages held captive by Hamas, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday he is committed to seeing the return of the remaining 101, but made clear that Hamas is the one that has refused to accept a hostage and ceasefire deal. He also said it is illogical and insane for Israel to make more concessions when the only thing that Hamas has done is murder more hostages.
They murdered six of our hostages in cold blood. Now the world will seriously demand that Israel make concessions after this massacre? What message is this sent to Hamas? I'll tell you what the message is. Murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. That's not only illogical, it's not only immoral, it's downright insane.
So how has the murders over the weekend changed the outlook of the Israel-Hamas war? Joining me now from Jerusalem to discuss it is Chris Mitchell. He's the Middle East Bureau Chief at CBN News. Chris, good to see you.
Good to see you, Joseph.
Now, first, on a personal note for you, you attended the Shiva of the father and mother of Hirsch Goldberg Polan. He was one of the hostages found murdered by Hamas only a few days ago. How are they doing? How are the developments like these impacting the situation there in Israel?
Well, like you can imagine, they're just in deep grief and anguish. The Shiva, as you said, and it's the Shiva is what the Jewish people do, the tradition, sitting Shiva for 7 days after the death of a loved one. We were talking about that earlier. It's a very healing time. And this is a remarkable Shiva. Literally hundreds of people were there today. It will end Sunday morning, and over the time, there'll be thousands of people that will come to sit down and just briefly express their condolences to Rachel and John Goldberg Polan. They really, and Hirsch in many ways, has become the poster child for the hostages. They had been literally here in Israel, in the United States, and wherever they could to plead for the safe rescue of Hirsch Goldberg, a young 23-year-old Israeli who really captured the hearts of many people. We were able to sit down with them just briefly, tell them that we've been praying for them, as well as millions of people around the world. And it really does speak to the anguish that that the Israeli people have gone through, especially in the last few days when these six Israelis were murdered and an Israeli-American as Hirsch. Really just almost a year now, these people have been in horrible, horrific conditions. Tortured, and then finally these six were executed. 101 remain, but Of those, maybe one third they realize are dead. So it speaks to the anguish of the Israeli people, but also the resilience that despite all the things that are going on. And earlier today, we talked to CEO of Our Crowd, John Medved, and talking about despite the fact that Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, these groups and organizations want to destroy Israel. He was making the point, but despite that, for thousands of years, groups like that and some much better than those organizations have tried to destroy the Jewish people. They failed. And that speaks to the resilience of the Jewish people and the state of Israel.
Yeah, Chris, for most of us, the conflict there in Israel is news and headlines and somewhat distant. But when you attend the Shiva of the parents of someone who's lost a son as a hostage, you realize how personal this is for so many people there. Now, at the top of the segment, I played part of Benjamin Netanyahu's comments from his press conference about how Israel should respond. Tell us a bit more about that. What do you think his posture is? What will the result of this be?
Well, his posture is being resolute against the demands of Hamas. Hamas, since the beginning of the negotiations, has had two main goals. First of all, they want the end of the war. They want the IDF to stop the war, and they want all the withdrawal of all the IDF troops. Now, to an Israeli point of view, and especially to Prime Minister Netanyahu and the coalition government right now, that means a defeat for Israel and a victory for Hamas, that it would survive and that it would be able to rearm and regroup. One of the main points he was making last night, Joseph, was the fact that there's a very strategic piece of land on the Egyptian-Gazan border. They call it the Philadelphia Corridor. And that's where they've discovered more than 150 smuggling tunnels. And actually, it was right near there where they found these six Israelis that were executed. This has been the oxygen allowing Hamas to arm itself and become what some people have called the largest terror base in the world. Now that those tunnels have been discovered, uncovered, many or most of them destroyed, Israel maintains that it needs to control this land to make sure that Israel does not rearm and regroup. There's a lot of pressure for Israel to get out of that place, but Netanyahu, by using a map and talking about the history of the place, believes that Israel needs to stay there to maintain security in Gaza and for Israel itself.
Israel has long maintained since October 7th that their goal in this conflict is not merely to reach a ceasefire, but to eliminate Hamas. How close are they to that objective? Does that remain the goal?
It does remain the goal, not only to destroy Hamas as a fighting force, but also make sure that Hamas can no longer govern the area called Gaza and Gaza Strip. They are close to that goal. Rafah was the last main stronghold that Hamas remained, and they have degraded or destroyed most of the 24 battalions of Hamas. There do remain pockets of resistance in northern Gaza, for example, but it is getting closer to, making sure that military.
Looks like we may have lost Chris there for a moment, and what he was there speaking about the ability of the Israeli government and their success in the effort to eliminate Hamas rather than just to negotiate some kind of ceasefire with them. We'll see if we have Chris Mitchell back. Of course, he's coming to us from Israel, and there are communication challenges when you talk to people on the other side of the world, and it sounds like we have him back. Chris, do we have you?
Yeah, we do. We do, Joseph.
Okay. Great to have you back. And you were just closing your thoughts there on how close Israel is to their goal of actually eliminating Hamas.
It is closer and very close to eliminating Hamas as a military fighting force and as an organization that would be able to govern Gaza once again. Those are the two main goals, as well as rescuing or getting the hostages back. What remains, Joseph, is a much greater threat to Israel is Hezbollah on the northern border. And just this past month, in August, there's been more than 1,000 rockets fired by Hezbollah. Once Gaza remains, will no longer be a threat to Israel, that will be the next much greater challenge to Israel.
Now, Chris, the story of the newly murdered hostages has grabbed the headlines over the last several days. But somewhat ironically, and Netanyahu referred to this in his press conference, it seems that the response from the global community has been not more pressure on Hamas, but more pressure on Israel to reach a ceasefire. Is that a fair characterization, and why would that be?
It is a fair characterization, and I think that's been the story of much of the war since October 7th, is that Israel is the one being put pressure on rather than Hamas. There are two kind of slogans about the hostages that relate to that. One is bring them back home, which really puts the onus on Israel, but let them go puts the onus on Hamas. And ironically, much of the world puts the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu, on the current coalition government. And yet there are nations like Egypt and Qatar in particular that have been aiding Hamas. Egypt, because of the many tunnels on its from its sovereign territory that go into Gaza, and Qatar, which has been funding to the tune of billions of dollars for the last 17 years since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip. So, and those are the ones that are actually part of the negotiating team. So many people say, put the pressure on Hamas, put the pressure on Qatar, and put the pressure on Egypt and not Israel.
Now, Chris, you say there that Egypt has been aiding Hamas through this series of tunnels. Now, of course, in the past, there have been tunnels connecting Gaza to Israel as well. And that was, of course, not an attempt of the Israeli government to aid Hamas. That was just something that Hamas had built. To what extent is the aid that's been coming from Egypt official or incidental just because of their geography and Hamas's ability to extract aid on their own?
Well, it doesn't seem to be official, Joseph, but in fact, a top Egyptian general was up on the Gaza border right now. They, too, are trying to put pressure on Israel to withdraw from that area. But it's hard to imagine Egypt having more than 150 tunnels in its right along the Egyptian-Gazan border and not know what was happening. There are some who speculate that many of the Egyptian generals or officials could have been complicit or at least turn a blind eye to what was happening for many, many years. Some of these tunnels, vehicles could drive through. And as I said before, many people said these tunnels were the oxygen that allowed Hamas to arm itself and during the war to rearm itself until Israel was able to take control of the strategic area called the Philadelphia Corridor.
Chris Mitchell, Middle East Bureau Chief at CBN News. We greatly appreciate your updates and your vigilance on tracking this story, and we're all better for it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joseph.
When we come back on the other side of the break, we will discuss the latest economic policies unveiled by Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris. What are they? Are they actually going to help? We'll also have a chance to compare them to what President Trump states he would do and give you as voters the opportunity to decide which path you will choose. Stay with us right after the break.
The news reflects the world we live in, but it also shapes it. Like it or not, what we learn about the world on a daily basis impacts our thinking, our worldview, and ultimately our action. So much of today's media is built on a shaky foundation that can send us hurling toward harmful ideas and hopeless solutions. Family Research Council created the Washington Stand to be a news outlet that speaks from a firm foundation, bringing you news, commentary, and analysis of what's happening in America and around the world. The Washington Stand is unapologetically biblical and uncompromisingly committed to truth. Equip yourself for the world we live in with a biblical worldview found daily at the Washington Stand. Find us at WashingtonStand.com. That's WashingtonStand.com.
Research has found that there are 59 million American adults who are a lot like you. There are millions of people around the country who are born again, deeply committed to practicing their faith, and believe the Bible is the reliable Word of God. But that's not all. They're also engaged in our government. They're voters. They're more likely to be involved in their community, and they're making a difference in elections. The problem is that a lot of them feel alone, too. We want to change that. FRC wants to connect these 59 million Americans to speak the truth together, no matter the cost. If you want to learn more about this group and what it means to be a spiritually active, governance-engaged conservative, or if you want to find out if you are one of these sage cons yourself, join us. Go to frc.org/sagecon, sagecon, to learn more. That's sagecon, sagecon, to learn more.
Hi, I'm Georgina, an intern here at Family Research Council, and I wanted to take a moment to tell you about FRC's incredible internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and a development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. This program features hands-on professional experience here in Washington, D.C., weekly biblical worldview training, tours around the district, opportunities to meet some of the country's most prominent policy experts, and more. The program also includes free housing, a meal stipend, and is available in spring, summer, and fall. If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, as a current intern, I cannot recommend this program enough. For more information or to apply, please go to frc.org/internships. Again, that's frc.org/internships. Apply today. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Yesterday, Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris unveiled more of her economic policies, including a proposal that would offer tax breaks for small businesses.
I want to see 25 million new small business applications by the end of my first term. So part of my plan is we will expand the tax deduction for startups to $50,000. It's essentially a tax cut for starting a small business.
Because the economy and inflation are top priorities for voters, many are wondering, how do Harris's economic policies compare to former President Trump's? And how do they compare to President Biden's? Joining me now to discuss this is Dr. Paul Mueller, Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Dr. Mueller, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
Well, walk us through the key points as you see them of Kamala Harris's economic plan for America.
Well, the way I see it is Kamala Harris is running a giveaway campaign. That is to say, she's trying to give away things to the American people. So the tax cut or the tax credit that she referred to with starting new businesses is one example. She's talked about increasing credits to first-time home buyers. She's talked about eliminating the tax on tips. Of course, the Biden administration has been trying to cancel various forms of student debt for years now. And her approach, I think, to stimulating the economy is more of what we've seen over the past 4 years, which is extensive government involvement, huge amounts of spending. It's not really an organic growth within the economy. It's more stimulative government involvement in trying to get things going.
Now, say a bit more about that, if you would. Why isn't it good? You know, we're consumers, we're homeowners, we're entrepreneurs, we'd like to start businesses. Why is it a bad idea to get a $50,000 tax credit to start my new business and $25,000 to buy my new house?
Sure. So I'm an economist. Economists always talk about the law of unintended consequences. And then that's the big thing we have to worry about here. So the big issue, which maybe we can come back to, is all of this adds to national debt, which is going to put pressure on national finances, other government programs, may lead to larger tax increases in the future, which the Harris campaign has also proposed, raising capital gains taxes, proposed a wealth tax. So there's no such thing as a free lunch, Milton Friedman used to say. But the other piece of it is you never quite know how people are going to respond. So when let's take the tax credit for starting new businesses. There are a lot of small business owners who maybe will close down their existing business and start a new one just to get the tax credit, right? And you're going to see funding of more businesses that maybe are riskier or more marginal. And in a normal setting, they wouldn't necessarily get off the ground, but with this big subsidy, maybe they will, and they won't be as efficient. So that's one thing to worry about. Let's talk about the home subsidy for a second, because this is also actually a very important concept. When we subsidize people's ability to buy things, so whether that's higher education or healthcare, and we give people money in the form of loans or grants or scholarships to do that, what it does is it boosts demand. And so what we see over time in both of those areas is rising costs. The cost of higher education has grown much faster than everything else in the economy. The higher the rate of increase for healthcare has increased very rapidly. And so this $25,000 credit for home first-time home buyers, while it sounds nice, is actually going to continue to put upward pressure on the price of housing overall. And so it's actually going to be eaten up by rising prices.
Yeah, you make an interesting point there about the ability to open and close businesses, because it could seem, because $50,000 is a lot of money in a tax credit, and it could, and it seems, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that could be a matter of paperwork, where one business says, well, I'm going to close this LLC and just transfer all the assets and all the operations to another LLC just so I can get a $50,000 cut, and economically, maybe nothing has changed at all. Is that the kind of loophole that would be created here?
Potentially. I mean, so they're gonna try, obviously, to avoid that. But one thing that we've seen in a very recent history is that large government programs that hand out a lot of money are not very good at policing fraud. And so if you look back at a number of the COVID programs, whether it was paycheck protection or other kinds of subsidies, we are still sorting out tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of fraudulent or at least incorrect kind of filings for payments for employees. It was a nightmare. It was a mess. It was a free-for-all with all that money being handed out. And this kind of thing, maybe at a smaller scale, I would not be surprised to see something very similar. Of course, they'll try to write the rules to avoid the exact thing that you suggest. But, you know, the devil's in the details, and people tend to be very clever and figure out ways to get around it. So that's just one reason to be concerned about something that sounds simple and really good might not be the best way. What we want instead is more sustainable fundamental policy change. And when it comes to overall tax policy, when it comes to regulatory policy, making it easier just to start businesses, to operate businesses, to not have the government on your back when you're working on these things, that would be, I would argue, a much better way to promote robust economic growth.
Is there anyone proposing that?
Well, elements of President Trump's agenda have pieces of that. So he has talked about wanting to roll back regulations. That was something that was a big part of his first term, and he's talked about making that a big part of the second term. That would be very helpful. Of course, there were the Trump tax cuts that happened a number of years ago under his term, and those are set to expire. And so I think he would probably work to keep those in place, and that would be helpful. Two downsides to the Trump campaign's approach, two things that would concern me or that are not going to help growth, are one, he has been has strongly endorsed tariffs, raising tariffs, which are forms of taxes on goods coming into and out of the country, or goods coming into the country, which make it harder to ship goods out of the country. So that's not great for growth. And then he hasn't really addressed runaway government spending. And the more money that is spent by the federal government, the less money there is for people in the private sector to spend on their businesses, their houses, their projects. So those are two areas where the Trump administration could, or the Trump campaign could be more pro-growth than they are. But on the regulation front, on the tax front, they would have a much better plan for robust economic growth.
You know, I wish we had more time to say more about your last point there, because $35 trillion of debt and growing every day seems to be something that we need to deal with. But so far, we are not seeing a lot of politicians raise their hand and say, I'm the guy that's going to give you less so we can save the future. I think that might be what we need. We're not getting that from anybody at this point, but we're going to have to save that conversation for another day. Dr. Mueller, thank you so much for your time.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Coming up next, great news out of Nicaragua, where 13 pastors and attorneys were wrongfully imprisoned for nearly 9 months, but now they are free. What happened? We'll give you the good news when we come back right after the break. Stay with us.
America was a bright light until the culture gave into darkness. But we won't. We're in a battle for the soul of our nation, between right and wrong, between truth and lies. At a time when the mainstream media is blocking Americans from truth, millions are searching for a source of trustworthy news that shines a light in the darkness. At this time of great need, FRC is lighting the way forward. For 40 years, Family Research Council and its partners have stood together to advance and defend biblical truth in government and culture. Between our flagship broadcast program, Washington Watch, with Tony Perkins, to our news outlet, The Washington Stand, FRC is providing believers across the country with news they can trust from a biblical worldview. When you stand with FRC, you help light the way forward for America and the next generation. Go to frc.org/give.
If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, check out Family Research Council's internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. Featuring hands-on experience, biblical worldview training, free housing, and more, this internship is a great opportunity for spiritual and professional development. Check out frc.org/internships to apply today.
As a congressman, Jody Heiss witnessed firsthand how the gradual erosion of congressional integrity has crippled America's faith in its most essential institutions. His newly released book, Sacred Trust, Election Integrity, and the Will of the People, sounds the alarm on the attempts of career bureaucrats to subvert our elections and provide solutions to make every vote count. Help preserve election integrity and order Sacred Trust today wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. You may recall that we've discussed on Washington Watch the plight of 11 pastors wrongfully jailed in Nicaragua on sham charges after they led Christian revivals that reached more than a million people. They were unjustly sentenced to prison terms ranging from between 12 to 15 years, handed down by the repressive regime of Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo, who also serves as his vice president. But today, your prayers and the prayers of many around the world were answered. Joining me now with an update is Britt Hancock, a missionary to Nicaragua with the ministry Mountain Gateway. Britt, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thank you so much. We're thrilled to be here with a wonderful report.
Now, first, for those who may not know the background, how did they end up in prison in the first place?
In 2023, our ministry held a series of mass evangelism campaigns in Nicaragua. We had 6,000 evangelical churches working together on that campaign and thousands of volunteers. We had just over a million people come together in those eight campaigns that we had in 2023. And the last campaign, we filled the national meeting space, the biggest space in the country, in Managua, the capital city. And we had over 200,000 people the last night of our campaign there. And a month after that happened, they began to arrest all of our staff and pastors that worked with us in that.
Why did they see that as a problem? Was it some kind of threat to the government? Did they perceive it that way?
We know that that's true. They have a history, particularly since 2018, of just really dealing harshly and crushing any people or group that they perceived as a threat that had any social influence, and particularly something that big that had that much unified, you know, response with such a large segment of the population. And so we know that that the freedom of the gospel doesn't mix well with totalitarian regime ideology. They're a communist dictatorship. And so that's just really their pattern for dealing with these kinds of things.
Britt, do you think it was because of their Christian faith specifically, or just the fact that they had a large group, they had influence, they had leadership in any way that an authoritarian government would perceive as at least a potential to be a threat, regardless of what motivates it ideologically?
We're sure that it was both. We were there for a long, long time as evangelicals, a Christian ministry, working on the ground, but not until we seized, you know, that, or we didn't seize, but not until the Lord really exploded such a massive movement. But the reason that movements of faith, particularly the gospel, is a threat to them is because we believe that relationship with Jesus is built on free will and love, and freedom is contrary to the tenets of communism. And the spiritual side of that is, you know, it's just the spirit of Antichrist. So however that gets expressed around the world, it's definitely religious persecution.
Well, you're here today, of course, because there's a happy ending to this story, and they spent 9 months in prison. And while I know that was not the preference of anybody, we've seen a good outcome. Tell us, how did these, what were 12 to 15 year sentences, unjust though they may be, end up being released after 9 months?
Boy, what a complicated situation. I came to Washington, D.C. in early February, my wife and I did, and we began to lobby Congress and engaged with people. Tony Perkins helped us greatly, and so many others in Congress, and the entire Alabama delegation, just multiple members of Congress. The State Department got engaged. The Department of Homeland Security got engaged. The White House engaged. And then, you know, as the press got involved, you all helped so much. So many, you know, likely tens of thousands or maybe millions of people were praying. Mm-hmm. And that created this, you know, matrix of pressure upon the Nicaraguan government. And then after I don't know how many weeks or months of negotiation directly by the State Department with the Nicaraguan government, they were able to successfully negotiate the release of our dear friends.
In Britain, about 30 seconds, how have you seen this story impact the church there in Nicaragua?
Well, right now what's going on is they're really shutting down many churches and ministries. I'm sure that the spiritual side of things is alive and well. The revival fire of God is burning in people's hearts. But this official repression is sowing a lot of fear and keeps people from speaking openly.
So this story is not over. We need to continue to pray. And of course, we need to pray for the gospel to continue to advance despite the oppression, but there's still work to do. Britt, thank you so much for your time today and your service to the kingdom.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
On the other side of the break, we'll discuss yesterday's tragic school shooting in Georgia, as well as the newly revealed writings of the Covenant school shooter when we come back. Stay with us.
The news reflects the world we live in, but it also shapes it. Like it or not, what we learn about the world on a daily basis impacts our thinking, our worldview, and ultimately our action. So much of today's media is built on a shaky foundation that can send us hurling toward harmful ideas and hopeless solutions. Family Research Council created the Washington Stand to be a news outlet that speaks from a firm foundation, bringing you news, commentary, and analysis of what's happening in America and around the world. The Washington Stand is unapologetically biblical and uncompromisingly committed to truth. Equip yourself for the world we live in with a biblical worldview found daily at the Washington Stand. Find us at WashingtonStand.com. That's WashingtonStand.com.
America was a bright light until the culture gave into darkness. But we won't. We're in a battle for the soul of our nation, between right and wrong, between truth and lies. At a time when the mainstream media is blocking Americans from truth, millions are searching for a source of trustworthy news that shines a light in the darkness. At this time of great need, FRC is lighting the way forward. For 40 years, Family Research Council and its partners have stood together to advance and defend biblical truth in government and culture. Between our flagship broadcast program, Washington Watch, with Tony Perkins, to our news outlet, The Washington Stand, FRC is providing believers across the country with news they can trust from a biblical worldview. When you stand with FRC, you help light the way forward for America and the next generation. Go to frc.org/give.
If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, check out Family Research Council's internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. Featuring hands-on experience, biblical worldview training, free housing, and more, this internship is a great opportunity for spiritual and professional development. Check out frc.org/internships to apply today.
As a congressman, Jody Heiss witnessed firsthand how the gradual erosion of congressional integrity has crippled America's faith in its most essential institutions. His newly released book, Sacred Trust, Election Integrity, and the Will of the People, sounds the alarm on the attempts of career bureaucrats to subvert our elections and provide solutions to make every vote count. Help preserve election integrity and order Sacred Trust today wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Quick reminder that the Pray, Vote, Stand Summit takes place October 3rd through the 6th in Washington, D.C. We'd love to have you join us. Visit PrayVoteStand.org for more information and to register today. Also, I again want to encourage you to make your voice heard with Family Research Council's 2024 election survey. If you are concerned about the direction of our nation, text the word election to 67742 to participate in our survey and to share your thoughts. Text the word election to 67742. Well, news updates continue to come out of yesterday's shooting at Appalachee High School in Barrow County, Georgia. But many questions remain, including the question that comes up after every shooting like this. Why does it happen? Well, yesterday's shooting eclipsed the news that broke earlier this week regarding another school shooter, Audrey Elizabeth Hale, and her long speculated about manifesto. The Tennessee Star was able to obtain and publish 90 pages of her writings from 2023. In it, the shooter describes her disturbing inner thoughts. And here with her insights on all of this is Dr. Jennifer Bowens, director of the Center for Family Studies at Family Research Council. Dr. Bowens has worked extensively as a clinician, providing trauma-focused treatment to children in foster care and behavioral health studies settings, and to adults who've experienced interpersonal traumas. Jennifer, welcome back to Washington Watch.
And it's good to be with you, Joseph.
Well, unfortunately, it is a heavy and sad subject that we take on now. And yesterday, there was yet another school shooting. It has become tragically common, it seems. How do you, as a mental health professional who deals in kind of trauma and brokenness often, how do you process news like this?
You know, we've been hearing for the last several years about the mental health crisis. And I would add to that, that we're both having a mental health and spiritual crisis. And there's just no one factor that contributes to this problem. We've been building for some time, for decades, I'd say, kind of creating a container, if you will, for a lot of these mental health issues to flourish and unfortunately flourish. And what we're seeing right now is a lot of the fruit of the breakdown in families and the rise in electronics, the rise of social media use, which are things that are supposed to bring us together, but in fact, bring us apart in many ways. And at the very heart of this is all about connection, because we were made for connection with both our creator and with each other. And we are living in a society where that is not happening. And so you're seeing a lot of the outgrowth of that lack of connection.
We have heard and talked a lot about the loneliness crisis, and you kind of allude to it there. Is it that simple? I mean, do we just have so many kids who are isolated and broken and alone and sad that they just wallow in that for a long enough period of time that some of them just snap and react this way? Is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, I think it is a big contributing factor, but there's certainly much more going on here, because it's not just a loneliness factor. That is a big part of it. We can look at attachment research and learn that the number of people who have good, secure connections over time has, over the last few decades, has gone down. So that is a fact, that kids are growing up in homes where they're not connected to a primary caregiver. So that has all kinds of implications. We've known that for years. But in addition to that, we have these ideologies, these radical ideologies that are sort of filling in the gap. You know, and when we turn to this whole issue with the Nashville shooter, we can readily see that this is a young woman who obviously was indoctrinated at some level against her own, everything about her own being, from her ethnicity to her biological sex. And so when you have an ideology like that at play, you have an easy sort of, all of my problems are from this issue. They're because I'm trans, or I was born the wrong ethnicity, born the wrong sex, all of that. And it becomes this catch-all, and it's really not even the primary issue at stake here. And it's certainly complicating the issues that are the real behind the scenes issues, like the loneliness crisis.
And Jennifer, I want to give you a chance to build on that. And I'm going to read a portion of the manifesto from the Nashville school shooter. As she said, "A terrible feeling to know that I am nothing of the gender I was born of. I am the most unhappy boy alive. I wish to be dead. I hate society because society ignores to see me. I'm a queer. I'm meant to die." End quote. It does seem to be a, you know, recitation of some kind of like cultural talking points, but it's clear that this is something she has internalized. What do you attribute this to? Because you noted how there's social media influences and all of these influences, but of course, most people who embrace gender ideology don't end up shooting up a school, thank God. What is going on here that makes situations like this happen, rare though they may be, too common?
Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of factors that we don't know regarding this particular situation. You know, we don't know if this young woman was actually on testosterone and that had an impact on her emotions, because that certainly would cause an emotional response when you have the wrong sex's hormones in your body. But beyond that, you know, we know from at age six, she's been in some kind of psychological counseling. We know that this young woman had all kinds of self-hatred from early on. She had eating disorders and so forth. So in that way, you do see sort of a typical profile of someone who is identifying trans as transgender, where there's all these other host of mental health issues. Now, you know, what exactly was the driver that caused her to go after a Christian school? We don't know exactly what that is. We have some idea because of her parents supposedly being Christians. You know, and there was some hatred of her father. There was a lot of anger towards her father for whatever reason, we don't know. So, you know, you're right in the sense that not everyone who identifies as transgender is going to carry out something horrific like this. But what we do know is that people who carry these things out have a lot of mental health issues. And that is certainly the case with people who are identifying as trans and they're not getting the proper care because there's this sort of catch-all diagnosis that isn't, it's not the real issue going on. It's masking the real issues. And this is readily seen with this young woman. It is so sad.
Yeah. And there's one thing that Christians are always mindful of as well, is the fact that we are constantly living in a spiritual battle. And we talk about mental health, and we understand that that's a real thing. And there is physical health, and we have physical bodies that live in a sinful world, which means they can be broken and damaged and not operate the way that they are intended. But we also know that we live in a world where evil exists. And that's a real thing, where we are dealing with demonic forces and Satan prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And he wants to destroy God's image bearers. Where's the line between something that is a mental health issue, which is a physical issue, and then you have a when you're dealing with actual evil, which is more of a spiritual issue, we think.
Yeah. Well, you know, there isn't, it's a very fine line, actually. You know, that's why the Old Testament talks about the priest, that they couldn't minister if they had, you know, a scab or they had something going on. And that wasn't to be cruel. It's basically to let us know, you know, God wants people to minister who are healed, because what happens is a lot of times when we have woundings that are unresolved or we've believed lies because of those woundings, then that actually opens up the door to evil forces to further torment us and further torment us as a vehicle to inflict that on other people. So healing is a very important issue, and mental health has a very much overlaps with spiritual issues. And, you know, certainly in this case, we're talking about someone who carried out murder. And, you know, we know that the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And so, you know, and obviously this young woman was very oppressed, you know, and had a lot of spiritual ideas, you know, and was willing to carry those out. And then that's, and that said, and I think in this case, if I imagine, you know, what would her life been like if transgender ideology hadn't been the backdrop of her experience? And what if those helping her, and I don't know that this is the fact, but what if those helping her had other means to help her through that pain instead of maybe looking to transgender ideology? We might be dealing with a very different story here. And I think that's what's important to remember.
Yeah, Jennifer, and to that point, I'm going to read another part of her manifesto and discuss how I think some of us are going to be inclined to respond to that. She said, "When I'm called a lady and ma'am," and then she swears, "it makes me not want to exist. The male body in me only exists only to me. I'm just more profanity tired of being called and identified by a gender I am not at all." And a lot of people will see that in the manifesto and say, see, the problem here is the refusal to accept her identity. It was the constant, persistent rejection that led her to do the things that she did that everybody would agree is an evil action. What's your response to that?
And I would take a totally different take on that. And I'm glad you pointed out, because what this highlights, it gives us a little insight into why some people who are identifying as transgender get so, you know, not to overuse this word, but triggered. And because there's so so in so much insecurity about who, what their identity is, that, you know, if you call me something different than what I'm trying to believe that I am, you're threatening to my very existence.
Right.
And that's actually never what mental health practices were devised to help with. Actually, we were supposed to, at me in the counseling field, we were intended to help people deal with the circumstances that are at hand, right? And to be able to manage ourselves regardless of what we face, and, you know, change those things as we can. But if we're all responding to life based on what other people do or don't do, we're going to be a very miserable life, because we all have circumstances or people call us things that we don't like. But, you know, if we're going to commit suicide based on those external conditions, we're going to be in trouble, and we're going to have a lot of loss.
Yeah. Jennifer, we've only got a couple minutes left, but I want you to speak, if you can, to the people connected to the young person yesterday in Georgia who did terrible evil, and then this school shooter in Nashville from last year. Parents, friends, classmates undoubtedly look at these situations and say, what did I do wrong that allowed somebody in my circle and maybe even very close to me to do acts of evil? What's your advice there? And undoubtedly, they kind of blame themselves. Maybe there's something I could have done that would have prevented this from happening. How do you encourage people to respond?
Well, I think actually what one of the former classmates of the Nashville shooter did was a really great response, and that she was texted by the shooter, and this young woman, this classmate, reported it right away. And I mean, that was a brilliant response, and she should be applauded for that. Now, it didn't translate into action that prevented it, but, you know, that's a brilliant response. And I mean, the other thing is, there's only so much we can do, right? Even as mental health professionals, when we're seeing things that alarm us, or as educators, and we're seeing things that alarm us, you know, unless there's real sort of in the moment cause, we can't always have someone arrested. We can do our part, which is to alert authorities if we see something. But, you know, in the meantime, I think what we're seeing is, as what the scripture says, the love of many is growing cold. And Jesus said that his people will be known by their love. And so this is an opportunity for us to even distinguish ourselves even more by the love and truth that we carry in Christ, and to show the world that there is another way.
Yeah. People who feel loved don't do things like this in general. We do live in a broken world, but love is going to be the solution. And ultimately that leads us to Jesus. Dr. Bowens, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be with you, Joseph.
And friends, we thank you for joining us here on Washington Watch. We look forward to getting together again tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.